On this episode of China Unscripted, a Bolivian activist joins us to talk about nonviolent resistance strategy, how her movement forced the Bolivian president to resign, and how China's demand for Bolivian beef ignited the fire. Hi, welcome to China Unscripted. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganista.
And before we get into the interview tonight, we are going to enjoy a little bit of tea from Path of Cha. Tonight, we're drinking organic, smoky Lapsang Souchong black tea. So, if you notice, there's a distinct aroma of a barbecue.
It is very smoky.
So the way this tea is made is the leaves are kind of roasted over an open fire, and so the smokiness gets infused into the tea itself. So have a sip.
Mmm.
It's sweeter than I thought it would be.
It's a very interesting flavor, how it has, there is that smokiness to it, and a distinct slight spiciness to it that you get in a good quality Lapsang Souchong. But then, yeah, the sweetness of the tea.
Reminds me of camping.
Doesn't it?
In the mountains of Tibet.
You camped in the mountains of Tibet?
No, I went to the mountains of Tibet, but I didn't camp there. I'm just, you know, I have this thing in my mind.
Yeah. Well, so that's the characteristic of a really good tea, that it invents memories you didn't have.
That's excellent.
Wow.
That's why tea is very enriching.
Yes.
So, again, a big shout out to our sponsor, Path of Cha. If you'd like to order some tea yourself, please go to go.pathofcha.com/unscripted. Get yourself some tea and you'll be helping out the show too. If you want to try what we're drinking tonight, again, it's organic smoky Lapsang Souchong black tea.
It's really nice. I was kind of expecting it to be like a little bitter or something, I guess.
It does have, because of that very strong smell that the leaves themselves have, and then the quality of the tea too. Yeah, it's a very unique tea experience, which I'm going to say is a tea experience.
Oh.
That's terrific.
Oh!
Look, we need to stop this tyranny of puns.
Help.
And you guys are in for a long podcast tonight.
And with that,
joining us now is Janice Vacadasa, Bolivian nonviolent activist and co-founder of the environmental activist group Standing Rivers. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you guys for having me.
Well, I was very sad to hear that your democratically elected president, Evo Morales, was forced to step down after a U.S.-led coup. How are you dealing with it?
Oh, you know, it's tough times here. It's very difficult. The U.S. cares so much about Bolivia. They don't even know where we are. My God, do you really expect Trump to know where Bolivia is in a map? That the fact that he didn't tweet about it, I think, already shows that the U.S. had nothing to do with this.
There's no Trump Tower in Bolivia, right?
No, thankfully.
So, okay, he doesn't know where it is.
But yeah, it's a mix of emotions right now. I'm very, very happy because finally we have a constitutionally placed president, Jeanine Añez, but also the pro-Morales groups are still being very violent, and I've been locked in a house for about 3 days. I haven't been able to leave because it's too dangerous for people like me to be on the streets, because you never know when you're going to be attacked. So I'm very happy, but I'm also hoping I can make it out of the city alive within the next 12 hours.
Where are you right now?
Yeah, I'm in La Paz.
Well, is that safe to say? Give us your exact location and
the
list of your
fears. Oh,
that's
not what I meant. I meant which city was she in?
Yes, please. Yeah. What are you most vulnerable to? Well, so for people listening who are, well, probably Americans and know nothing about Bolivia, can you give us a quick rundown of what's happened?
So essentially, we had the same president for the last 14 years. He changed the law and he just ignored the constitution in order to make himself president as many times as possible.
My favorite kind of president.
Yeah, you know, legalizing indefinite re-election, hashtag democracy. And then in the last elections that we had, which were October the 20th, his party committed such a obvious fraud. It was so clear that they committed fraud that people just got really pissed off. It was like the last tip of, I don't know how to say it in English, like the last thing that pushed us over the edge. And we just decided to go in open civil disobedience. We were We went on a general strike. We stopped the country for 20 days. And then yesterday, well, it's 21 today. And yesterday, after the OAS came up with a report, which officially indicated that, yes, indeed, there was a fraud and Morales didn't win the elections, most of his supporters started backing out. So we already had a big part of the Bolivian population protesting. But then yesterday, his last remnants of support were so embarrassed to see that he committed such an obvious fraud that they asked him to step down. And when once the police and the army denied the government when they gave them the orders to repress protesters, police even marched with us with white handkerchiefs and said that they're not going to shoot their own people. He had to step down. And obviously, he created this whole narrative that this is a coup, that the military is behind this. But the simple fact that, one, the military didn't take power. We've had just half an hour ago, the new president took place, which is the president of the Senate after everyone else quit. And also, the military essentially did nothing. They just didn't shoot at us, but they also didn't shoot at anyone from the government. They just said, we're not going to shoot.
I really wish Hong Kong police would take a lesson from Bolivian police.
Yeah, that's what we got a lot of inspiration from Hong Kong, actually. Like, in my movement's page, Standing Rivers, we posted videos about Hong Kong protests and how they deal with infiltrators and stuff like that. So I admire that movement so much. Many people in my movement admire them so much, and the way that they've organized and how they're so efficient at mobilizing in a decentralized way, that it's kind of surreal to think that we've achieved victory before they did. But I mean, they have a way bigger opponent on their end.
Well, we definitely want to get into some of the tactics you guys used and the parallels to what's happening in Hong Kong. But like, I know this is something I think both you and Shelley kind of want to rant a bit about, but like the idea that this is being called like a far right U.S. backed coup.
Everybody on Twitter is suddenly an expert on Bolivia in the last 2 days.
I swear.
Yeah.
The half the country was burning for almost 2 months. And this happened specifically because Bolivia signed an agreement with China that they were going to export beef. So we needed to expand agro-cattle territory, which is why Morales signed a law making it legal to use quote-unquote controlled fires to expand agro-cattle areas into forest areas. So we had a huge crisis right when the Amazon forest crisis happened, because our forest was by the Amazon, so that entire area was on fire. And Paraguay even said that they're going to take legal action against Morales because our fires, which he authorized legally, crossed into Paraguay and burned a lot of that country as well. And we were in such desperate need of international help, and we made social media campaigns. We ask people to please support us because we don't have a proper firefighters department. They're all volunteers. And the government refused to declare a national emergency, even though we lost the size of the territory that we've lost is as big as Switzerland.
Whoa.
So we need
an international.
And
that's all that's been burned by fires that were intended to help Chinese agriculture.
Beef agriculture.
Exactly. And it was 6 million hectares that were lost. 6 million. And the government just refused to call for a national emergency. So people like me, who flew back to Bolivia bringing donations, we had to face like legal consequences. They even tried to take away my passport. They took away my suitcases. And during that whole time when we lost firefighters, one of the firefighters that passed away was the brother of a person in Standing Rivers. And the international community didn't care at all. All they wanted to talk about was Bolsonaro, how horrible Bolsonaro is. And it was like, Bolivia lost the same amount of forests and we're such a small country. And no one even cared about what was happening with us. And now suddenly, everyone is an expert in Bolivia. Everyone cares about indigenous people and our national parks. And everyone thinks they know what's happening here. So what we've said within the country is like, the international community ignored us for so long. How could we expect them to understand that we just had one of the most beautiful, peaceful revolutions in the last decade? Mm. Sorry, I had to rant.
No, I mean, please. Like, it's been pretty ridiculous seeing some of the way that we look at things through our own political lenses that can distort completely what's happening on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when you were on our podcast a year ago, you know, you were basically telling us, like, these are all the things that are happening. This is what Morales is doing, and he's signing the deals with the Chinese Communist Party, and like the people are upset with him for breaking all his promises to help the indigenous people and all of this. And, you know, because we were trying to look up, you know, what was happening in Bolivia, and there was almost no media information a year ago. And what in you English, had provided right? In English, yeah. What you had provided on our show was like some of the only information about that anywhere.
Yep.
It's also interesting when you have, you know, people like Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the Labour Party in the UK, you know, praising Morales as an indigenous leader and saying how beloved he was by his country and how what a shame it was that he was like taken out in a coup. Then, you know, obviously people who are not that familiar with what's happening are going to believe people who have, you know, like, of course, he's the leader of a major political party in the UK. Of course he knows what he's talking about, right?
You would expect him to. And, you know, one of the most interesting things that happened the day that Morales quit this Sunday is that the COP, the Central Obrera Boliviana, which is the Bolivian Workers Union, which is one of the oldest, most powerful leftist unions in the country, they took away their support from Morales. And they asked him, please, for the stability and peace of the country, please quit, like, resign. And the fact that that group, which is, like, the highest left in Bolivia, and then the Ponchos Rojos, which is an indigenous group that's very radical as well and leftist, they also asked Morales to step down. Like, it's the first time I've seen so much unity between so many different ends of the political spectrum in Bolivia. And when you have someone like Jeremy Corbyn or like people that represent the left internationally calling this a right-wing coup without realizing that people that have the actual right to call themselves leftists, because it's so much different to be leftist in Bolivia, especially if you lived through the 80s dictatorships, like they have so much more legitimacy for me. And you have all of these people that live in such a privileged state calling this a right-wing coup. It's so, I mean, agape, at the end of the day, I believe in the words of Martin Luther King, I believe these people must have good intentions. They're just misinformed. But it's very annoying to see people making such strong statements about your country when we actually needed the attention of the international community. They didn't care that we were burning.
It does remind me of the situation in Venezuela, where the sort of the same narrative is going on, that, oh, it must be, again, U.S.-backed far-right extremists.
Yeah. And it's like, it's also kind of insulting, because I've seen tweets where they say, like, it's impossible that Bolivians could have organized themselves this well. The U.S. must be behind it. Like, what, we're not smart enough that to have our own nonviolent revolution? Like, we have to have a white Western person leading all of this? It's also a lot of misinformation as to how the Bolivian society is composed, because indigenous people in Bolivia, by culture, they tend to be very peaceful, especially in the lowlands. So what we've had right now is a reflection of a lot of hard work from people like the people in my team in Standing Rivers talking about nonviolence, but also the resistance of indigenous people that have been defending their natural areas from invasion of Morales policies. So it kind of everything came together at the right time.
I have seen this kind of narrative that Morales, when he came in, was very beloved and he was a great leader, until very recently, when all the power suddenly went to his head and, you know, he started becoming a dictator. Is that how it happened?
I believe he was more than him. I believe the party that he's in, the MAS, made so many promises of wonderful things that Bolivia needs, like bringing dignity and respect back to indigenous people, pushing for female rights, and just bringing dignity back into Bolivian people, because we had been downplayed by so many politicians before. But the people around him were definitely very corrupt. The vice president comes from a guerrilla. Like, he was in jail for being a terrorist, essentially. And then as time went on, a lot of people say that as time went on, he got more and more authoritarian. I, myself, being from Sucre, which was a city where this government killed 3 people within the first year just because they were protesting, we had been calling on this from year 1. But I think the party started with amazing people like Filemón Escobar, who was an amazing thinker of the left in Bolivia. But I guess power corrupts people.
Surely it won't corrupt me when I seize power. All right, but so I know a lot of people hearing about this might think this kind of happened overnight, that, you know, suddenly there was a 20-day protest, or 21 days now, and Morales was gone. But this has been building up a long time, correct?
Yes, years and years.
And so, go ahead.
No, you tell me.
No. I don't want this to be, you know, a U.S.-backed, U.S.-led podcast.
U.S.-led interview. No, I mean, I think the point where everything started moving away from Morales was when the repression in Chaparina happened, which was, I believe, 2011 or 12. When that was an indigenous group, the Tipnis, that was protesting because the government wanted to open the area to build a road through it. And when they had such a strong, violent repression against indigenous people, which we all expected Morales to respect, it was a moment when a lot of people realized something is wrong here. And that's been building up for years. I think the difference of why this time we were successful, unlike many other previous times, is that finally we achieved unity. And I would dare to say that that's even a bigger achievement, even than bigger than Morales leaving, because Bolivia is so diverse. But for the first time, you had the head of the Civic Committee, which is this kind of very elite economic group in Santa Cruz that represents many other areas of the place, hugging with the head of the Ponchos Rojos, which is a very radical indigenous group from the highlands. So that image itself, and then him asking for forgiveness if people from Santa Cruz were ever racist to people from other parts of the country, and then this other indigenous leader saying, we forgive you, if you're ever racist again, you'll have to deal with us, but we thank you so much, and now we're all united, like this is a new Bolivia. That sort of unity that came out of all of us realizing that we were on our last chance to save democracy, I think is going to be the key to whatever comes next.
So in a way, Morales brought everybody together.
Yeah.
It brings a tear to my eye, even more than all that tear gas the police there fired.
I can't imagine what it must feel like to be in a country where everyone is unified. I don't think I've ever experienced that.
I'm sorry.
Well, so what are you feeling now? What are people feeling now that Morales is gone?
We're all very happy and hopeful, and the fact that the president is a woman from a rural area on the lowlands makes all of this even more amazing. It's also been it's been like a roller coaster since the day of the elections, when we realized that they had committed fraud, because we really didn't know what was going to happen. And today in the OAS, Almagro, the secretary general, was giving many statements about how this was not a coup. If there was someone that tried to make a coup, it was Evo Morales, because he was stealing the vote of the people. And Almagro had been a very vocal supporter of Morales up until before the election. So that was a shock to all of us. So there's a lot of sense of victory, but there's also grief, because we've lost three people, and I believe maybe there's more people that passed away today. There's been a lot of loss in our side, because the government sent very violent paramilitary groups, Nicaragua style, to attack protesters that were peacefully protesting, and even to burn down the houses of journalists that exposed the fraud that happened on the elections. So I'm just hoping now we can get to a point of reconciliation, and that the violence stops, because we have been having violence attacks from the pro-Morales groups yesterday here in La Paz. It was kind of a horrible scene. I've never been so scared in my life, because people asked everyone to, like, we had to barricade the doors, shut down all the lights, close all the windows, because these paramilitary groups were coming in. And the police were trying to protect people, but they were outnumbered. So in the end, the military had to step in. So the military airplanes were flying everywhere. And I mean, thankfully, there were no confrontations that resulted in deaths that I know of. But the fact that you have to shut down your lights and close your windows and barricade your door just in case these violent groups come in to kill you because you're an activist, or simply because you're in La Paz, that's not a beautiful thing to live through, and I really, really hope my country never has to go through this again.
Jeez.
Yeah.
So I know you've been involved in this movement for a long time. What's been your role?
I was one of the founders of Standing Rivers, Rios de Pie, which was born in Santa Cruz in kind of the lowlands, but now we have people across the country. And I think we kind of just try to lead by example. We're not very militant. We don't like ask people to do specific things. We just say, hey, we're going to do this. Do you want to join? So we did a lot of sit-ins within the last week, because in Bolivia, a lot of people, when we protest, they like to go and like take public institutions. And we decided that instead of going into the institutions, because that could get violent, we were just going to sit outside the institution holding signs asking them to close because we were on a general strike. So we shut down a lot of banks. That was very inspired by the MLK civil rights movement. We just sat outside the door with signs, and it was enough to shut down. I feel like we shut down like 5-6 banks. We shut down the taxes office. We shut down the TV state TV station. We shut down a lot of institutions by simply sitting out there. It's amazing the power of nonviolence. And it got replicated eventually, and then eventually everyone was just like shutting down institutions by holding nonviolent protests outside the institutions without going in or even yelling, because it was silent protest. So we were kind of bringing many ideas. We helped a lot with social media. We brought a lot of people into Twitter, because Bolivians are normally in Facebook. And yeah, we tried to coordinate with all the many opposition players. I feel like we're one of the very few independent grassroots movements that has the capacity to talk to civic committees and political parties, because they all know by now that we're going to do what we're going to do. So they better listen.
So you guys organized a lot of sit-ins, right?
Yeah, a lot of sit-ins, a lot of, what else did we do? Blockades.
Well, it sounds to me like you should have called it Sitting River.
Oh, okay.
No. We also organized a lot of blockades of streets, so we had to be standing for a long time.
Okay, good. I'm glad for that clarity.
That was a terrible joke, Chris. Yeah. Stole from Matt.
So I know you have subscribed to the theory of nonviolent resistance, and clearly in the case of Bolivia, this has worked. Can you tell us a little bit about a nonviolent resistance movements and how they actually attack a government and bring change?
You're making nonviolence seem pretty violent if you use the word attack.
Well, that's exactly. Nonviolent resistance is not like just peaceful, frou-frou, ha-ha stuff. It's like serious regime-changing stuff.
It's a strategic invitation for key players to join your side, because you essentially use your body in protest to bring injustice to the surface and ask people to heal it. Because that's essentially what we did. I mean, a lot of Bolivians knew that this government was violating our rights for years. I mean, we had the guy in power for 14 years. But it wasn't until we made the roadblocks and the sit-ins and all of this stuff that all of this injustice that they created, we just brought it to the surface through dramatizing it with protest. And we did it in such a big way nationally that they had to start giving us some concessions. And eventually they just had to leave the country because they lost every ally they had. And I think what happened with Morales is what happens with many dictators. If they just played by the book and they respected democracy, they would probably be more successful at keeping at least their parties running for longer than they do when they just keep violating rights of people. Because people, when they want freedom and when they're united and organized, which is what nonviolence achieves, they will fight for what they deserve. You can't just put a lid on stuff and pretend it's not there.
Right, but if the dictator follows all the laws, then he wouldn't be a very good dictator, would he?
Yeah, exactly. But then, I mean, Martin Luther King used nonviolence not against a dictator, but for like to establish civil rights. And then I know we were going to keep using it in Standing Rivers to defend environmental rights. So, I mean, I'm just very happy we got to do it here and it went well. I hope it keeps going well, though. It's very soon still to claim victory.
I think what's interesting is, you know, Standing Rivers is an environmental group, but you manage through a series of nonviolent actions to get all these different interest groups on board, culminating in the police marching with you in the final days leading up to Morales's resignation. So how did you build this? Like, how did you use nonviolence to build these alliances with all these different interest groups that otherwise would have had nothing to do with each other?
I mean, the government united us. They were our best recruiter. They did so many bad things to so many different parts of society that it came to a point where everyone was pissed off and we were like, okay, what are we going to do about it?
Sounds familiar.
And Standing Rivers kind of really talked about nonviolence with a lot of people, but I wouldn't dare to say that we led this revolution. I think there were many, many players into this. And we were just like fortunate enough that we had the right message at the right time. And in the end, it wasn't even like the name of Rios de Pie was all over the country. It was the idea of nonviolence, which is why Standing Rivers was created in the first place. So the method was what stuck. And that's why I think we were successful more than a specific group. And I think one of the greatest things that we did at Standing Rivers is that we tried to reach out to the wives of policemen about 2 years ago. And we had a lot of people that had been talking to police, and we were very aware of all the grievances they go through because they have really low salaries. They're very disrespected by other authorities in the country. They are very mistreated by people themselves. So when it came to the moment that we were all united and we had positive messages for police, and then one of the first police groups to side with the people was in Sucre, the city where I'm from. And as soon as they did that and they marched with white handkerchiefs, because they, a lot of people say it was because they were outnumbered by the number of protesters, which could also be a big factor into it. But I also think the fact that most of the people in resistance to Morales, because of nonviolence, we always try to keep a positive language towards the police and chanting stuff to them, like saying, we are with you. Evo doesn't care about you. We do. Like, you're not alone. Please side with us. Eventually, they started doing it. And it was amazing because I was here in the past outside the general command of the police, like nationally. And they were, this was the last place where they sided with us. Like, everywhere else in the country, police had sided with us and they hadn't yet. And we were just there, like, singing the anthem. And then we realized that every time we sang the anthem outside their headquarters, they would start singing with us as well. And then as we started like giving them speeches and stuff, telling them that we were with them, even though they couldn't move or say anything, many of the policemen started crying. And I went up and hugged one of them. That video is on my Twitter. But it was the little signs that we kept looking for until eventually they all sided with us, even the army.
Wow.
That is pretty incredible. I'm curious, though. I know you've said you got a lot of inspiration from Hong Kong protests. But one thing that I've seen in the Hong Kong protests is that there has not been a real push to kind of reach out to the Hong Kong police force.
Yes.
Or their wives.
But I wonder, is that because are the police in Hong Kong from Hong Kong, or do they bring them from other parts of China?
Well, that's one of the big things people are
questioning. That is a question, but I think still the majority of police in Hong Kong are still Hong Kong police.
Yeah. And I guess there would be the problem that even if somehow the protesters did get the Hong Kong police on their side, then there's the PLA that they'd have to worry about.
Right.
Exactly. It's a very different battlefield, so I wouldn't dare to criticize at all. I really admire and respect the Hong Kong movement. I have had some conversations with some activists from Hong Kong, though, and I always stress the need to remain nonviolent. But I also know that's very difficult to do when you're moving so many people. Like, you can train everyone. So one of the things we learned from them, though, and we loved it, and we always look at that video, is the fact that they sing happy birthday to infiltrators.
Oh, that's something that they were doing in 2014 during the Umbrella Movement, remember? Like, somebody would come up in the crowd and then, like, try to make trouble within the protesters, and then the protesters would start singing happy birthday to him.
Oh, my gosh, that's pretty funny.
Yeah,
I remember being confused by that.
Yeah, right?
It's such a great thing, though. We copy that here, and we don't sing happy birthday. We sing the national anthem, but it works as well.
Well, so I noticed one common trait to these sort of nonviolent resistance movements is the use of humor. And like, I know you told me that humor played a big role in a lot of the protests that happened in Bolivia. I think you gave me the example of a birthday party for a pothole.
Yes, we did a birthday party for a pothole. The greatest one recently, and it backfired on us, but then we managed to do it well, is that when the government was having their own people marching against us, they would have the police bring them fried chicken for lunch. So you would see policemen bringing boxes of fried chicken for the marchers that Morales was calling. So we, like, this just happened spontaneously. Standing Rivers had nothing to do with this, but people just started calling the police to order delivery of fried chicken. And then the chief of police had to give, like, a press statement asking people to please stop calling the police for fried chicken. And then I guess they felt so bad. They realized that they were being humiliated by the government because they're the police. They shouldn't be delivering fried chicken to protesters that the government wants to have on national media. So the next day, the day after that was the day that the police decided to side with the people. And then we started this whole campaign of, we're so sorry for ordering fried chicken from you. We will bring you fried chicken now. We love you all so much.
Wow.
But it was so funny when it happened.
Gosh. And would you mind just explaining the pothole birthday thing for Shelley, who looks very confused?
No, I remember the story.
Yeah, happened in May. So the municipality in Santa Cruz is terrible. I think they're our next beautiful guests in this nonviolent revolution. But they never do what they have to do, and one of the things is fixing the roads. And there was a pothole in this neighborhood that neighbors had been asking to get fixed for a long time, and the municipality didn't do anything. So they decided to celebrate a birthday for the pothole. They had, like, a cake and a clown and all of this. They invited the media, which found it so funny, so it made to the news. And then I think within the week the municipality went there and fixed the pothole because it was too embarrassing for them.
I sense a theme here. But what's interesting about that pothole birthday story, too, is the idea that, like, okay, when we think of nonviolent protests or, you know, dictators stepping down, it's all the kind of, you imagine, like, the people, like, filling the square and, like, marching through the streets, but you don't think about all of the work that went into it years ahead of time or months ahead of time.
Yes.
With these, like, small things that, you know, a pothole, but it makes a difference in the lives of people. So they will care about a pothole, you know, as, like, a symbol of, like, all the things that the government is corrupt and not doing well. So that's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also trying to find the fun in it, because, I mean, resisting an authoritarian government can be a very stressful and horrible experience. So trying to use laftivism to find the joy within the pain is really useful, I think. In our case, it has been, because it's been really, really stressful. Especially the whole fire situation really took a toll emotionally on the entire team.
What did you call it? Laftivism?
We used a lot of laftivism after the fires crisis, but during it, it was a very, like, I was very worried that we were not going to recover for the elections because we already thought there was going to be fraud. But we came up with a lot of funny protests that I think brought our spirits back up.
Well, I guess I kind of like to think of myself as a laftivist with what I do with the show.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you.
Is that just a... like, you're just fishing for a compliment.
I wasn't fishing for a compliment. I was stating a fact, uh-huh. Shelley.
So, Janice, if I wanted to overthrow Chris, how would I do it?
Wait, what?
If I wanted to overthrow Chris, how would I do it, you know, nonviolently?
You would have to do an investigation into the pillars of support that keep Chris in power.
Uh-huh.
And realize what are the key... institutions, or I guess in this case people that support him, without which he wouldn't be able to work. And then you come up with really creative protests to convince that people to side with you.
So you're saying I have to get mad on my side?
Yeah, and I don't think you're gonna have much of an issue doing that.
Well, okay, so but what if I bring to bear overwhelming violence on Shelley?
Shelley, we can have a private discussion about okay. that. I don't want them to know your strategy.
Well, okay, but the pillars of support thing is a pretty interesting thing. In Bolivia, what were the pillars of support that you were targeting?
We had 12, and we got all of them. So I'm very happy about that,
well,
too.
So what are pillars of support?
Pillars of support in nonviolence are essentially key institutions or key players on the arena that you have to make sure that you understand and you work with if you want to build a successful movement. And normally you start with the weakest one and you use slacktivism to get it done. So in our case, the one we kind of started with was a municipality in Santa Cruz, because we were already very annoyed at how they don't respect environmental rights. And we wanted to use slacktivism and create a protest to both practice and see what we could do about that pillar. And successfully, like, again, we didn't have to do much. Authoritarian authorities usually do the work for you in that sense. So we just had creative protests around the different abuses of power that they had going on. And that helped us gain a lot of momentum. It helped us gain a lot of supporters and also, like, show people that you can protest through other means without necessarily having to go on the street even.
So what were the other pillars of support for the Morales regime?
We started with the municipality. We knew that at the end the police was going to be key, so we always had positive messages towards them. The international community was very important as well, so we tried to have Bolivians abroad. I mean, everyone kind of self-organized. It's not like Standing Rivers orchestrated all of this, but Bolivians abroad did a really good job at explaining to environmental NGOs that this government was not respecting environmental rights or indigenous rights. Let's see, another key pillar was the health system, I guess. And we didn't have to do anything about that either, because the whole health doctors, they went on strike even before the fires happened. So they were also against the government. And eventually, like, all of these little parts, indigenous people, workers' unions, they all themselves realized that the government was playing against them. So they kind of ended up siding with us. And that's essentially the pillars moving towards you.
So this is interesting. Like, I know a lot of the, or at least some of the complaints the people of Bolivia had was the relationship the government had with China. I wonder if the Chinese Communist Party is watching the nonviolent resistance movement in Bolivia and their success and keeping that in mind for how to deal with Hong Kong.
I'm not sure. I do know, however, that Maduro, the president of Venezuela, already gave a threat to the Venezuelan opposition, like, don't you even think of doing what the opposition did in Bolivia. I'm going to put you all in jail. So if Maduro is worried, we're doing our job well.
Okay. So as long as I tell Shelley, if she even tries to make a move against my seat of power, I'll put her in jail. It'll work, right?
Then, Shelley, in that case, we make you a martyr, we make you even more famous, and we get more support for the movement.
You know, it almost would be worth it.
But do you think that this is the tactics that you used in Bolivia could be used in other countries?
I'm hoping, especially the ones with how to deal with infiltrators. But again, every country is so different, even every city is so different, that you cannot copy what other countries do. You have to figure it out yourself and see what works for your own culture and what kind of leftivism works with the people that you're working with, and what are the pillars that you have to work on. So more than learning specific tactics, I think the key to nonviolent success is learning how to strategize.
But so you think there are general blueprints that all nonviolent resistance movements use?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on your culture. You have to do a very good analysis of what you do. And the three principles are universal. I think they apply to everything. And that's the one thing that Standing Rivers repeated every day. It was unity, planning, discipline. Those three words, unidad, organización, disciplina, we've said it so many times and we've said it to everyone. And we kept those three principles in mind throughout all of this, which is why I also think we managed to be successful. And many movements that have failed in many countries failed because they failed at one of these three principles. It's not that hard to figure that out. So, I mean, I think nonviolence can do wonders, and I mean, Standing Rivers is not planning to stop here. We're going to keep using it for many other positive changes in society. And hopefully we'll get to share it with other countries as well.
Did you expect Morales to step down so quickly?
it was within what we had hoped for, but it was still very unbelievable to live it through.
So what are some of the challenges that comes next? Like, from what you say, you don't exactly feel very safe right now.
Yeah, no, not at all. In this very minute, I don't. And I think one of the biggest challenges is going to be to figure out what to do about the fact that pro-Morales groups keep being violent against citizens. And I mean, there's so much we can do. And obviously, we're never going to react violently, but we can keep losing people and having people dying on our side while we're being nonviolent because these people decide to attack. So I don't want to call and say, like, this is a job for the police and the military, but I do want to see what can we figure out to bring reconciliation. And for these people that are Morales supporters to realize that the fact that Morales is gone, it doesn't mean that everyone is suddenly gonna, like, go over them. We all have to learn to live together as Bolivians because we're all here. Morales left, but his supporters are here. So all of us need to learn how to get along and respect each other's rights above everything else and figure out how to reconciliate and move forward.
So what are the next steps? There's going to be an election?
There should be new elections because the last ones were frauded. So the new president that just took power today, she should be calling on elections within the next 90 days. For that, we need a new electoral tribunal that's going to be transparent because clearly we can't have the same one that we just had that committed this huge fraud. And we need to make sure that the people that work in the tribunal are people that the citizenry trusts and that are very transparent, because should we have another fail election, that would be horrible for the country. So first step, I think, is building the new electoral tribunal and the people that are going to carry out the new elections logistically, making sure that we have enough international people overseeing the process, and as well as very neutral players taking part on the overseeing of the election. Organizing again, I can't believe we're going to have to do this again, but the citizenry needs to organize yet again to do vote control on the day of the election. And then hopefully once we have the elections, we will begin working towards consolidating democracy and the transitional government. So there's still a lot of work to do.
Do you think this is something that will spread throughout Latin America? I mean, Venezuela does come to mind.
I'm hoping. I know a lot of people in Sending Rivers are saying that we should go to Venezuela now, but we have work to do here first.
But Maduro said no.
Yeah, no. But I hope it spreads. And I hope this is a good example as to why things are better if they are kept nonviolent. That was always my hope, that Bolivia might be an example on that. And maybe, I mean, again, we can't sing victory yet. There's still a lot of things that need to be done. But I think we've proven that unity and nonviolence can really change countries.
Well, I know us here at China Unscripted and China Uncensored all wish you guys the best of luck. It's been amazing, you know, meeting you a year or two ago and seeing how the movement has evolved and to at least getting Morales kicked out. That was amazing to watch.
Thank you so much for your support. And because, like, without China's answer, many people, even Bolivians, wouldn't know what happens in Bolivia. That interview really went viral here.
The TV interview we did with you on China Uncensored last year?
Yeah, it went viral in Bolivia. Like, a lot of people within Bolivia know me still. Like, oh, you're the girl that talked about China.
Wow. Are you Literally. Saying we're responsible for Eva Morales'
oh,
fall?
God.
The power. Dictators beware. China
the amount censored. Of times I've been introduced into a room of people like, remember the interview about China? It's this girl. And I'm like, oh my god, hi.
Wow.
All
right.
I mean the power you hold in your hands, guys.
Gosh,
be responsible.
I thought my biggest contribution to the world would be helping spread the room, but fortunately this is done better. All right. Well, so great. If somebody wants to know more about you, where should they go? Your Twitter?
You can look me up on Twitter, or you can, even better, go to Standing Rivers. We're on Twitter as standing rivers. We finally have a Spanish account, which is Rios de Pie, and an English one, which is Standing Rivers, because we have a bigger team now, and we can tweet in English as well. And if you go there, you'll probably see me replying and retweeting to stuff, and you can keep up with the news in Bolivia as well.
And what's your Twitter? Like, give us your
Twitter.
It's
Janice V. Daza, so J-H-A-N-I-S-S-E V-D-A-Z-A. It's a little long, sorry.
Yeah, and you've actually been tweeting, you know, this whole time about all these protests, and it's been really interesting to see all that. The footage and stuff that you have, and
thank you.
The international media hadn't picked it up before, but now they are.
I was literally live tweeting while running away from a protest yesterday. Like, we are evacuating.
We know what that's like.
Like, you're trying to type and your hands are shaking. Yeah.
Yep. And you're trying to look at the road and making sure you don't crash into anyone. But also you want to make sure that the Twitter folks know what's happening.
I'm having Hong Kong flashbacks. All right. Well,
you guys are troopers. You went there so quickly. I remember that.
Yeah.
It's nothing to the people who are there all the time.
Yeah, we've watched videos of how they use water bottles to turn off tear gas, to learn how to do that here. Thankfully, we didn't have to, though. The police never really repressed us that much.
That's great. Well, again, thank you for joining us, and yeah, best of luck.
Thank you.
Well, how about that, guys? We brought down Morales.
I'm not sure that's what she was saying.
We brought down
Morales.
Yeah, Shelley, I'm on your side on this one. You've got my pillar of support.
Thank you.
Oh, God, it's already happening.
Watch your back.
Well, so for everyone listening, what I recommend doing is, obviously, this is a world-changing show. You should probably sit down and enjoy an episode with a nice cup of tea. And remember, to get that tea, go to Path of Cha. The website is go.pathofcha.com/unscripted. Pick up a cup of organic, smoky Lapsang Souchong black tea. And we'll see you on the next episode of the China Unscripted podcast.
Which dictator will we overthrow next?
Hopefully not me. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganesta.
Talk to you next time.